didn't exactly conform with those of the higher-ups, and I quit after a little over 2 years. I apologized to the president, but there it was. Aka took out a packet of Marlboro Reds. Do you mind if I smoke?
Not at all, Tsukuru said.
Aka put a cigarette in his mouth and lit it with a small gold lighter. His eyes narrowed, and he slowly inhaled, then exhaled.
I tried quitting, but just couldn't. If I can't smoke, I can't work. Have you ever tried giving up smoking?
Tsukuru had never smoked a cigarette in his life. Aka continued. I'm more of a lone wolf type. I might not look like it. And I didn't understand that part of my personality until I'd graduated from college and started work. But it's true. Whenever some moron ordered me to do something stupid, I'd blow my top. It was like you could actually hear my brain explode. No way a person like that can work for a company. So I made up my mind. I had to go out on my own.
Aka paused and gazed at the purplish smoke rising up from his hand, as if tracing a far-off memory. One other thing I learned from working in a company was that the majority of people in the world have no problem following orders. They're actually happy to be told what to do. They might complain, but that's not how they really feel. They just grumble out of habit. If you told them to think for themselves and make their own decisions and take responsibility for them, they'd be clueless. So I decided I could turn that into a business. It's simple. I hope this makes sense.
Tsukuru said nothing. It was a rhetorical question.
I compiled a list of things I dislike, things I don't like to do, and things I don't want others to do. And based on that list, I came up with a program to train people who follow orders from above, so that they could work more systematically. I guess you could call it an original idea, but in part I ripped off elements from elsewhere. The experience I had myself, the training I received as a newly hired bank clerk, was extremely valuable. I added methods taken from religious cults and personal development seminars to spice things up. I researched companies in the U.S. that had been successful in the same sort of business. I read a lot of books on psychology as well. I included elements from manuals for new recruits in the Nazi SS and the Marines. In the half year after I quit my job, I literally immersed myself in developing this program. I've always been good at focusing on one particular task.
It helps that you're so bright. Aka grinned. Thanks. I couldn't very well come right out and say that about myself.
He took a puff on his cigarette and flicked the ash into the ashtray. He raised his head and looked at Tsukuru.
Religious cults and personal development seminars mainly try to get money from people. To do that, they perform a rather crude form of brainwashing. We are different. If we did something that questionable, top corporations wouldn't agree to work with us. Using drastic measures, forcing people to do things. We're not into any of that. You might get impressive results for a while, but they won't last. Driving the idea of discipline into people's heads is important, but the program you use to do it has to be totally scientific, practical, and sophisticated. It has to be something society can accept, and the results need to be long-lasting. We are not aiming at producing zombies. We want to create a workforce that does what their company wants them to do, yet still believes they're independent thinkers.
That's a pretty cynical worldview, Tsukuru said.
I suppose you could see it that way.
I can't imagine that everyone who attends your seminars allows themselves to be disciplined like that.
No, of course not. There are quite a few people who reject the program. You can divide them into two groups. The first is antisocial. In English, you'd call them outcasts. They just can't accept any form of constructive criticism, no matter what it is. They reject any kind of group discipline. It's a waste of time to deal with people like that, so we ask them to withdraw. The other group is comprised of people who actually think on their own. Those it's best to leave alone. Don't fool with them. Every system needs elite people like them. If things go well, they'll eventually be in leadership positions. In the middle, between those two groups, are those who take orders from above and just do what they're told. That's the vast majority of people. By my rough estimate, 85% of the total. I developed this business to target the 85%.
And your business is doing as well as you hoped it would?
Akka nodded. Things are working out now pretty much as I calculated. It was a small company at first, with just a couple of employees. But now it's grown larger, as you can see. Our brand's become pretty well known.
You've assessed the tasks that you don't like to do, or the things that you don't like to have done to you, analyzed them, and used this to launch your business. That was the starting point?
Akka nodded. Exactly. It's not hard to think about what you don't want to do or have done to you, just like it's not hard to think about what you would like to do. It's a difference between the positive and the negative, a question of emphasis.
I'm not too fond of what he's doing, Tsukuru recalled Ao's words. Aren't you doing this in part to get personal revenge on society, as one of the elites, someone who thinks like an outcast?
You could be right, Akka said.
He laughed happily and snapped his fingers.
Great serve. Advantage, Tsukuru Tazaki.
Are you the organizer of these programs? Do you do the presentations yourself?
In the beginning, I did. I was the only person I could count on at that point. Can you picture me doing that?
No, not really, Tsukuru replied honestly.
Akka laughed. For some reason, though, I turned out to be really good at it. I shouldn't brag, but I was well suited for it. Of course, it's all an act. But I was good at seeming real and convincing. I don't do it anymore, though. I'm not the guru, but more of a manager. And I keep plenty busy. What I do now is train our instructors and leave the practical side of things to them. These days, I've been giving a lot of outside lectures. Corporations invite me to their meetings, and I give talks at university employment seminars. A publisher asked me to write a book, too, which I'm working on.
Akka crushed out his cigarette in the ashtray.
Once you get the knack, this kind of business isn't so hard. Just print up a glossy pamphlet, string together some high-blown self-advertising language, and get some smart office space in a high-end part of town. Purchase attractive furnishings, hire capable, sophisticated staff members, and pay them very well. Image is everything. You don't spare any expense to create the right image. And word of mouth is critical. Once you get a good reputation, momentum will carry you. But I'm not planning to expand beyond what we do now. We'll continue to focus solely on companies in the greater Nagoya area. Unless I can keep an eye on things myself, I can't ensure the level of quality.
Akka gazed searchingly into Tsukuru's eyes.
Come on. You're not all that interested in what I do, are you?
It just feels strange. I never would have thought, back when you were a teenager, that you would open this kind of business someday.
Me either, Akka said, and laughed. I was sure I would stay in a university and become a professor. But once I got to college, I realized I wasn't cut out for academic life. It's a stagnant, crushingly dull world, and I didn't want to spend the rest of my life there. Then, when I graduated, I found out that working for a company wasn't for me either. It was all trial and error, and eventually, I was able to find my own niche. But what about you? Are you satisfied with your job?
Not really. But I'm not particularly dissatisfied with it either, Tsukuru said.
Because you can do work related to railroad stations.
That's right. As you put it, I'm able to stay on the positive side.
Have you ever had doubts about your job?
Every day I just build things you can see.
I have no time for doubts.
Akka smiled.
That's wonderful, and so very like you.
Silence descended on them. Akka toyed with the gold lighter in his hand, but didn't light another cigarette. He probably had a set number of cigarettes he smoked every day.
You came here because there was something you wanted to talk about, right?
Akka said.
I'd like to talk about the past, Tsukuru said.
Sure. Let's talk about the past.
It's about Shiro.
Akka's eyes narrowed behind his glasses, and he stroked his beard.
I was kind of expecting that after my secretary handed me your business card.
Tsukuru didn't reply.
I feel sorry for Shiro, Akka said quietly. Her life wasn't very happy. She was so beautiful, so musically talented, yet she died so horribly.
Tsukuru felt uncomfortable at the way Akka summed up her life in just a couple of lines. But a time difference was at work here, he understood. Tsukuru had only recently learned of Shiro's death, while Akka had lived with the knowledge for 6 years.
Maybe there's not much point in doing this now, but I wanted to clear up a misunderstanding, Tsukuru said. I don't know what Shiro told you, but I never raped her. I never had a relationship like that with her of any kind.
The truth sometimes reminds me of a city buried in sand, Akka said.
As time passes, the sands pile up even thicker, and occasionally it's blown away, and what's below is revealed. In this case, it's definitely the latter. Whether the misunderstanding is cleared up or it isn't, you aren't the type of person to do something like that. I know that very well.
You know that?
Tsukuru repeated the words.
Now I do, is what I mean. Because the sand has blown away? Akka nodded. That's about the size of it.
It's like we're discussing history.
In a way, we are.
Tsukuru gazed at the face of his old friend seated across from him, but couldn't read anything resembling an emotion in Akka's expression. You can hide memories, but you can't erase the history that provided them. Tsukuru recalled Sara's words and said them aloud.
Akka nodded several times.
Exactly. You can hide memories, but you can't erase history. That's precisely what I want to say. Anyway, back then the four of you cut me off. Totally and mercilessly, Tsukuru said.
It's true, we did. That's a historical fact. I'm not trying to justify it, but at the time we had no other choice. Shiro's story was so real. She wasn't acting. She was really hurt. An actual wound with real pain and real blood. There was no room for us to doubt her at the time. But after we cut you off, and the more that time passed, the more confused we got about the whole thing.
How do you mean?
Akka brought his hands together on his lap and thought for 5 seconds.
In the beginning, it was small things, a few details that didn't fit, parts of her story that didn't make sense. But it didn't bother us much. They didn't really matter at first. But these started to become more frequent, and we noticed them more and more. And then we thought, something's not right here.
Tsukuru was silent, waiting for him to continue.
Shiro might have had some mental issues.
Akka fiddled with the gold lighter, carefully choosing his words.
Whether it was temporary or more of a long-term condition, I don't know. But something was definitely wrong with her then.
She had a lot of musical talent. The kind of beautiful music she played blew us away. But unfortunately, she demanded more from herself. She had enough talent to make her way through the limited world where she lived, but not enough to go out into the wider world. And no matter how much she practiced, She couldn't reach the level she desired.
You remember how serious and introverted she was. Once she entered the music conservatory, the pressure only mounted, and little by little she started acting strangely.
Tsukuru nodded but didn't say anything.
It's not so unusual, Aka said. It's a sad story, but in the art world it happens all the time. Talent is like a container. You can work as hard as you want, but the size will never change. It'll only hold so much water, and no more.
I'm sure that kind of thing does happen a lot, Tsukuru said. But saying that I drugged her in Tokyo and raped her, where did that come from? Granted, she might have had mental issues, but didn't that story just come out of nowhere?
Aka nodded. Absolutely it came out of nowhere, which actually made us believe her at first. We couldn't conceive of Shiro making up something like that.
Tsukuru pictured an ancient city, buried in sand, and himself seated on top of a dune, gazing down at the desiccated ruins.
But why was the other person in that story me, of all people? Why did it have to be me?
I couldn't tell you, Aka said. Maybe Shiro secretly liked you. So she was disappointed and angry with you for going off to Tokyo by yourself. Or maybe she was jealous of you. Maybe she wanted to break free of this town. Anyway, there's no way now to understand what motivated her, assuming there even was a motivation.
Aka continued toying with the lighter.
There's one thing I want you to know, he said. You went to Tokyo, and the four of us stayed behind in Nagoya. I'm not trying to criticize you for that, but you had a new life in a new city. Back in Nagoya, the four of us had to draw closer together as a result. Do you know what I'm trying to say?
It was more realistic to cut off me as the outsider than to cut off Shiro, right?
Aka didn't reply, but let out a long, shallow sigh. Of the five of us, maybe you were the toughest one, at least emotionally. Unexpectedly so, considering how placid you seemed. The four of us who stayed behind weren't brave enough to venture out like you did. We were afraid of leaving the town we were brought up in, and saying goodbye to such close friends. We couldn't leave that warm comfort zone. It's like how hard it is to climb out of a warm bed on a cold winter morning. We came up with all kinds of plausible excuses at the time. But now I see how true this was.
But you don't regret staying here, do you?
No, I don't think so. There were lots of good, practical reasons for staying put, and I was able to use these to my advantage. Nagoya's a place where local connections really pay off. Take the president of the consumer finance company who invested in me. Years ago, he read about our volunteer efforts in high school in the paper, and that's why he trusted me. I didn't want to profit personally from our volunteer program, but it worked out that way. And many of our clients are people my father taught at the university. There's a tight social network like that in business circles in Nagoya, and a Nagoya University professor is like a respected brand name. But none of that would make any difference if I went to Tokyo. I'd be completely ignored. Don't you agree?
Tsukuru was silent.
Those practical reasons played a part, too, I think, in why the four of us never left town. We chose to keep soaking in the warm bath. But now, it's only Ao and me who are still here. Shiro died, and Kuro got married and moved to Finland. And Ao and I are literally down the street from each other but never meet up. Why? Because even if we got together, we'd have nothing to talk about.
You could buy a Lexus. Then you'd have something to talk about.
Aka winked. I'm driving a Porsche Carrera 4. Togatop. 6-gear manual transmission. The way it feels when you shift gears is amazing. The feeling when you downshift is especially great. Have you ever driven one?
Tsukuru shook his head.
I love it, and would never buy anything else, Aka said.
But you could buy a Lexus as a company car, write it off.
I have clients whose companies are affiliated with Nissan and Mitsubishi, so that's not an option.
A short silence followed. Did you go to Shiro's funeral? Tsukuru asked.
Yeah, I did. I'm telling you, I've never seen such a sad funeral before or after. It's painful to think about even now.
Ao was there too.
Kuro couldn't come. She was already in Finland, about to have a baby.
Why didn't you let me know that Shiro had died?
Aka didn't say anything for a while, gazing vacantly at him, his eyes unfocused.
I really don't know, he finally said. I was sure someone would tell you. Probably Ao would.
No. Nobody ever told me. Until a week ago. I had no idea she'd died.
Aka shook his head and turned, as if averting his gaze, and gazed out the window.
I guess we did something terrible. I'm not trying to excuse our actions, but you have to understand how confused we were. We didn't know what we were doing. We were positive you would hear about Shiro's murder. And when you didn't show up at the funeral, we figured you found it too hard to come.
Tsukuru didn't say anything for a moment, and then spoke.
I heard that at the time Shiro was murdered, she was living in Hamamatsu.
She was there for almost 2 years. She lived alone and taught piano to children. She worked for a Yamaha piano school. I don't know the details of why she moved all the way to Hamamatsu, though. She should have been able to find work in Nagoya.
What kind of life did she lead?
Aka took a cigarette out of the box, put it between his lips, and, after a short pause, lit it.
About half a year before she was murdered, I had to go to Hamamatsu on business. I called her and invited her to dinner. By this time, the four of us had really gone our separate ways and hardly ever saw each other. We'd get in touch every once in a while, but that was it. My work in Hamamatsu was over sooner than I expected, and I had some free time. So I wanted to see Shiro for the first time in a while. She was more collected and calm than I'd imagined. She seemed to be enjoying having left Nagoya behind and living in a new place. We had dinner together and reminisced. We went to a famous unagi eel restaurant in Hamamatsu, had a few beers, and really relaxed. It surprised me that she was able to drink. Still, there was a bit of tension in the air. What I mean is, we had to avoid a particular topic.
That particular topic being me?
Aka shot him a hard look and nodded. It still made her uneasy. She hadn't forgotten it. Apart from that, though, she seemed perfectly fine. She laughed a lot and seemed to enjoy talking, and everything she said sounded normal. It struck me that moving to a new place had been great for her. But there was one thing. I don't enjoy bringing this up, but she wasn't attractive like she used to be.
Wasn't attractive?
Tsukuru repeated the words, his voice sounding far away.
No, that isn't quite the right expression, Aka said, and thought it over. How should I put it? Her features were basically the same as before, of course, and by all standards, she was definitely still a beautiful woman. If you hadn't known her when she was a teenager, you'd think she was pretty. But I knew her from before, knew her very well. I could never forget how appealing she was. The Shiro in front of me now, though, she wasn't.
Aka frowned slightly, as if recalling that scene.
Seeing Shiro like that was very painful. It hurt to see that she no longer had that burning something she used to have. That what had been remarkable about her had vanished. That the special something would no longer be able to move me the way it used to.
Smoke rose from Aka's cigarette above the ashtray. He continued.
Shiro had just turned 30 then, and she was still young.
When she met me, she had on very plain clothes, with her hair pulled back in a bun, and hardly any makeup. But that's not really the point. Those are just details. My point is that she'd lost the glow she used to have, her vitality. She was always an introvert, but at her core there had been something vital and alive. Something that even she wasn't totally aware of. That light. That radiance used to leak out by itself, emerging from between the cracks. Do you know what I mean? But the last time I saw her, it was all gone. Like someone had slipped in behind her and pulled the plug. The kind of fresh, sparkling glow, what used to visibly set her apart, had disappeared, and it made me sad to look at her. It wasn't a question of age. She didn't get that way simply because she'd gotten older. When I heard that someone had strangled Shiro, I was devastated and felt really sorry for her. Whatever the circumstances might have been, she didn't deserve to die like that. But at the same time, I couldn't help but feel that the life had already been sucked out of her, even before she was physically murdered. Aka picked up the cigarette from the ashtray, took a deep drag, and closed his eyes. "She left a huge hole in my heart," Aka said. "One that's still not filled." Silence descended on them, a hard, dense silence. "Do you remember the piano piece Shiro used to play a lot?" Tsukuru asked. "A short piece, Liszt's Le Mal du Pays?" Aka considered this and shook his head. "No, I don't recall that. The only one I remember is the famous piece from Schumann's Scenes from Childhood. Träumerei. She used to play that sometimes. I'm not familiar with the Liszt piece, though. Why are you asking?" "No special reason. I just happened to recall it," Tsukuru said. He glanced at his watch. "I've taken so much of your time. I should be going. I'm really happy we could talk like this." Aka stayed still in his chair and gazed straight at Tsukuru. He was expressionless, like someone staring at a brand new lithograph with nothing etched in it yet. "Are you in a hurry?" he asked. "Not at all." "Can we talk a little more?" "Of course. I have plenty of time." Aka weighed what he was about to say before he spoke. "You don't really like me very much anymore, do you?" Tsukuru was speechless, partly because the question had blindsided him, but also because it didn't seem right to reduce his feelings for the person seated before him into a simple binary equation of like or dislike. Tsukuru carefully chose his words. "I really can't say. My feelings are definitely different from back when we were teenagers. But that's..." Aka held up a hand to cut him off. "No need to mince words. And you don't need to force yourself to like me. No one likes me now. It's only to be expected. I don't even like myself much. I used to have a few really good friends. You were one of them. But at a certain stage in life, I lost them. Like how Shiro, at a certain point, lost that special spark. But you can't go back. Can't return an item you've already opened. You just have to make do." He lowered his hand and placed it on his lap. He began tapping out an irregular rhythm on his kneecap, like he was sending a message in Morse code. "My father worked so long as a college professor that he picked up the habits professors have. At home, he always sounded like he was preaching at us, looking down on us from on high. I hated that ever since I was a child. But at a certain point, it hit me. I've started to talk just like him." He went on tapping his kneecap.
I always felt I did a horrible thing to you, it's true.
We had no right to treat you that way.
I felt that someday I needed to properly apologize to you. But somehow, I never made it happen.
It doesn't matter, Tsukuru said. That's another situation where you can't go back.
Aka seemed lost in thought.
Tsukuru, he finally said, I have a favor to ask.
What kind?
I have something I want to tell you, a confession you might call it, that I've never told anybody before. Maybe you don't want to hear it, but I want to open up about my own pain. I'd like you to know what I've been carrying around with me. Not that this will make amends for all the pain you endured. It's just a question of my own feelings and emotions. Will you hear me out, for old time's sake?
Tsukuru nodded, uncertain where this was going.
Aka began. I told you how, until I actually went to college, I didn't know I wasn't cut out for academic life, and how I didn't know I wasn't cut out for company life either, until I started working in a bank. You remember? It's kind of embarrassing. I probably had never taken a good, hard look at myself. But that's not all there was to it. Until I got married, I didn't understand how I wasn't suited for marriage. What I'm saying is, the physical relationship between a man and a woman wasn't for me. Do you see what I'm getting at?
Tsukuru was silent, and Aka went on.
What I'm trying to say is, I don't really feel desire for women. Not that I don't have any desire at all, but I feel it more for men.
A deep silence descended on the room. Tsukuru couldn't hear a single sound. It was a quiet room to begin with.
That's not so unusual, Tsukuru said to fill in the silence.
You're right. It's not so unusual. But to confront that reality at a certain point in your life is a hard thing. Very hard. You can't just dismiss it with generalities. How should I put it? It's like you're standing on the deck of a ship at sea at night, and suddenly you're thrown overboard, alone, into the ocean.
Tsukuru thought of Haida, about how in the dream, and he presumed it was a dream, he'd come in Haida's mouth. Tsukuru remembered the utter confusion he had felt at the time, being thrown overboard, alone, into the sea, at night. The expression hit the mark exactly.
I think you just need to be honest with yourself as much as you can, Tsukuru said, choosing his words. All you can do is be as honest and free as you can. I'm sorry, but that's about all I can say.
I know you're aware of this, Aka said. But although Nagoya's one of the largest cities in Japan, in a way it's not all that big. The population's large, industries are doing well, and people are affluent. Yet the choices you have are unexpectedly limited. It's not easy for people like us to live here and still be honest with ourselves and free. Kind of a major paradox, wouldn't you say? As we go through life, we gradually discover who we are. But the more we discover, the more we lose ourselves.
I hope everything will work out for you. I really do, Tsukuru said. He truly felt that way.
You're not angry with me anymore?
Tsukuru gave a short shake of his head.
No, I'm not angry with you. I'm not angry with anybody.
Tsukuru suddenly realized he was using the familiar omai to address Aka. It came out naturally at the end. Aka walked with Tsukuru to the elevators.
I may not have a chance to see you again, Aka said as they walked down the hallway.
So there's one more thing I wanted to tell you.
You don't mind, do you?
Tsukuru shook his head.
It's the first thing I always say at our new employee training seminars. I gaze around the room, pick one person, and have him stand up. And this is what I say. I have some good news for you and some bad news. The bad news first. We're going to have to rip off either your fingernails or your toenails with pliers. I'm sorry, but it's already decided it can't be changed. I pull out a huge, scary pair of pliers from my briefcase and show them to everybody. Slowly, making sure everybody gets a good look, and then I say, "Here's the good news. You have the freedom to choose which it's going to be, your fingernails or your toenails. So, which will it be? You have 10 seconds to make up your mind. If you're unable to decide, we'll rip off both your fingernails and your toenails." I start to count. At about 8 seconds, most people say, "The toes." "Okay," I say. "Toenails it is. I'll use these pliers to rip them off. But before I do, I'd like you to tell me something. Why did you choose your toes and not your fingers?" The person usually says, "I don't know. I think they probably hurt the same. But since I had to choose one, I went with the toes." I turn to him and warmly applaud him, and I say, "Welcome to the real world." Tsukuru gazed wordlessly at his old friend's delicate face. "Each of us is given the freedom to choose," Aka said, winking and smiling. "That's the point of the story." The silver door of the elevator slid open soundlessly, and they said goodbye. Chapter 12. Tsukuru got back to his apartment in Tokyo at 7 p.m. on the day he had met Aka. He unpacked, tossed his laundry in the washer, took a shower, then called Sara's cell phone. It went to voicemail, and he left a message telling her he had just gotten back from Nagoya and to get in touch with him when she could. He waited up until after 11, but she didn't call. When she did call back the next day, a Tuesday, Tsukuru was in the cafeteria at work eating lunch. "Did everything go well in Nagoya?" Sara asked. He stood up and went out into the corridor, which was quieter. He summarized his meetings with Ao and Aka at the Lexus showroom and Aka's office on Sunday and Monday, respectively, and what they had talked about. "I'm glad I could talk to them. I could understand a little better what happened," Tsukuru said. "That's good," Sara said. "So it wasn't a waste of time." "Could we meet somewhere? I'd like to tell you all about our conversations." "Just a minute. Let me check my schedule." There was a 15-second pause. While he waited, Tsukuru gazed out the window at the streets of Shinjuku. Thick clouds covered the sky, and it looked like it was about to rain. "I'm free in the evening the day after tomorrow. Does that work for you?" Sara asked. "Sounds good. Let's have dinner," Tsukuru said. He didn't need to check his schedule. It was blank almost every night. They decided on a place and hung up. After he switched off the cell phone, Tsukuru felt a physical discomfort, as if something he'd eaten wasn't digesting well. He hadn't felt it before he'd spoken to Sara. That was for certain. But what it meant, or whether it meant anything at all, he couldn't tell. He tried to replay the conversation with her as accurately as he could remember it. What they'd said, her tone of voice, the way she had paused. Nothing seemed any different from usual. He put the cell phone in his pocket and went back to the cafeteria to finish his lunch. But he no longer had any appetite. That afternoon and the whole next day, Tsukuru, accompanied by a brand new employee as his assistant, inspected several stations that required new elevators. With the new employee helping him to measure, Tsukuru checked the blueprints one by one that they kept at the office against the actual measurements at the sites. He found a number of unexpected errors and discrepancies between the blueprints and the actual sites. There could be several reasons for this, but what was more important at this point was to draw up accurate, reliable blueprints before construction began. If errors were discovered after they had begun construction, it would be too late, like combat troops relying on a faulty map when landing on a foreign island.
After they'd finished their measurements, they went to talk with the station master about potential problems the rebuilding might cause. Repositioning the elevators would change the configuration of the entire station, which in turn would affect passenger flow, and they had to make sure they could structurally incorporate these changes. Passenger safety was always the top priority, but they also had to be certain that the station staff could perform their duties with the new layout. Takuru's job was to synthesize all these elements, come up with a rebuilding plan, and include this in an actual blueprint. It was a painstaking process, but critical because people's safety was at stake. Takuru patiently managed it all. This was the kind of process that was exactly his forte, clarifying any problems, creating a checklist, and carefully making sure each and every point was handled correctly. At the same time, it provided a wonderful opportunity for the young, inexperienced new employee to learn the ropes on site. The employee, whose name was Sakamoto, had just graduated from the science and engineering department at Waseda University. He was a taciturn young man with a long, unsmiling face, but he was a quick study and followed directions. He was skilled when it came to taking measurements, too. This guy might work out, Tsukuru thought. They spent an hour at an express train station with the station master, going over the details of the rebuilding project. It was lunchtime, so they ordered in bentos and ate together in the station master's office. Afterward, they chatted over tea. The station master, a friendly, heavy-set middle-aged man, told them some fascinating stories about things he had experienced in his career. Takuru loved going to sites and hearing these kinds of stories. The topic turned to lost property, more specifically to the huge amount of lost and found items left behind on trains and in stations, and the unusual strange items among them. The ashes of cremated people, wigs, prosthetic legs, the manuscript of a novel. The station master read a little bit of it and found it dull. A neatly wrapped, blood-stained shirt in a box. A live pit viper. 40-color photos of women's vaginas. A large wooden gong. The kind Buddhist priests strike as they chant sutras.
"Sometimes you're not sure what to do with them," the station master said. "A friend of mine who runs another station turned in a Boston bag once that had a dead fetus inside. Thankfully, I've never had that kind of experience myself, but once, when I was a station master at another station, someone brought in two fingers preserved in formaldehyde."
"That's pretty grotesque," Takuru said.
"Yes, it sure was. Two small fingers floating in liquid, kept in what looked like a small mayonnaise jar. All inside a pretty cloth bag. Looked like a child's finger severed at the base. Naturally, we contacted the police, since we thought it might be connected to a crime. The police came over immediately and took the jar away."
The station master drank a sip of tea.
"A week later, the same police officer who'd taken the fingers stopped by. He questioned the station employee who'd found the jar in the restroom again. I was present for the questioning. According to the officer, the fingers in the jar weren't those of a child. The forensics lab determined that they belonged to an adult. The reason they were so small was that they were six vestigial fingers. The officer said that sometimes people have extra fingers. Most of the time, the parents want to get rid of the deformity, so they have the fingers amputated when the child's still a baby. But there are some people who, as adults, still have all six fingers. The ones that were found were an example. The fingers of an adult who had had them surgically removed, then preserved in formaldehyde. The lab estimated the fingers to be those of a man, age mid-20s to mid-30s, though they couldn't tell how long it had been since the fingers had been amputated. I can't imagine how they'd come to be forgotten, or perhaps thrown away in the station restroom. But it doesn't seem that they were connected to any crime. In the end, the police kept them, and no one ever came forward to claim them.
For all I know, they may still be in a police warehouse somewhere.
That's a weird story, Tsukuru said. Why would he keep those six fingers until he became an adult and then suddenly decide to amputate them?
It's a mystery. It got me interested in the phenomenon, though, and I started looking into it. The technical term is hyperdactyly, and there have been lots of famous people who've had it. It's unclear whether it's true or not, but there was some evidence that Hideyoshi Toyotomi, the famous leader of the Sengoku period, had two thumbs. There are plenty of other examples. There was a famous pianist who had the condition, a novelist, an artist, a baseball player. In fiction, Hannibal Lecter of The Silence of the Lambs had six fingers. It's not all that unusual. And genetically, it's a dominant trait. There are variations among different races, but in general, one out of every 500 people is born with six fingers. As I said, though, the vast majority of their parents have the extra fingers amputated before their children's first birthdays, when kids begin to develop fine motor skills. So we hardly ever run across someone with the condition. It was the same for me, until that jar was found in the station. I'd never even heard of such a thing.
It is strange, though, Tsukuru said. If having six fingers is a dominant trait, then why don't we see more people with them?
The station master inclined his head.
Don't know. That kind of complicated stuff is beyond me.
Sakamoto, who'd eaten lunch with them, opened his mouth for the first time. Hesitantly, as if rolling away a massive stone that blocked the mouth of a cave.
I wonder if you wouldn't mind if I venture an opinion.
Of course, Tsukuru said, taken by surprise.
Sakamoto was not the type of young man who voiced his own opinion in front of others.
Go right ahead.
People tend to misunderstand the meaning of the word dominant, Sakamoto said. Even if a certain tendency is dominant, that doesn't mean it becomes widespread throughout the population. There are quite a few rare disorders where genetically there is a dominant gene, but these conditions don't, as a result, become common. Thankfully, in most cases these are checked at a fixed number and remain rare disorders. Dominant genes are nothing more than one among many elements in tendency distribution. Other elements would include the survival of the fittest, natural selection, and so on. This is personal conjecture, but I think six fingers are too many for human beings. For what the hand has to do, five fingers are all that are necessary, and the most efficient number. So, even if having six fingers is a dominant gene, in the real world, it only manifests in a tiny minority. In other words, the law of selection trumps the dominant gene. After holding forth at such length, Sakamoto stepped back into silence.
That makes sense, Tsukuru said.
I get the feeling it's connected with the process of how the world's counting systems have mainly standardized, moving from the duodecimal system to the decimal system.
Yes, that might have been a response to six and five-finger digits, now that you mention it, Sakamoto said.
So how come you know so much about this? Tsukuru asked Sakamoto.
I took a class on genetics in college. I sort of had a personal interest in it.
Sakamoto's cheeks reddened as he said this. The station master gave a merry laugh.
So your genetics class came in handy, even after you started work at a railway company. I guess getting an education isn't something to be sneezed at, is it?
Tsukuru turned to the station master.
Seems like for a pianist, though, having six fingers could come in pretty handy.
Apparently it doesn't, the station master replied. One pianist who has six fingers said the extra ones get in the way. Like Mr. Sakamoto said just now, moving six fingers equally and freely might be a little too much for human beings. Maybe five is just the right number.
Is there some advantage to having six fingers? Tsukuru asked.
From what I learned, the station master replied, during the Middle Ages in Europe, they thought people born with six fingers were magicians or witches, and they were burned at the stake. And in one country during the era of the Crusaders, anybody who had six fingers was killed. Whether these stories are true or not, I don't know. In Borneo, children born with six fingers are automatically treated as shamans. Maybe that isn't an advantage, however.
Shamans? Tsukuru asked.
Just in Borneo.
Lunchtime was over, and so was their conversation. Tsukuru thanked the station master for the lunch, and he and Sakamoto returned to their office. As Tsukuru was writing some notes on the blueprints, he suddenly recalled a story Hayata had told him years ago about his father. How the jazz pianist who was staying at the inn deep in the mountains of Oita had, just before he started playing, put a cloth bag on top of the piano. Could there have been, inside the bag, a sixth right and left finger, preserved in formaldehyde inside a jar? For some reason, maybe he'd waited until he was an adult to get them amputated, and always carry the jar around with him. And just before he performed, he'd put them on top of the piano, like a talisman. Of course, this was sheer conjecture. There was no basis for it, and that incident had taken place, if indeed it had actually occurred, over 40 years ago. Still, the more Tsukuru thought about it, the more it seemed like this piece of the puzzle fit the lacuna in Hayata's story. Tsukuru sat at his drafting table until evening, pencil in hand, mulling over the idea. The following day, Tsukuru met Sara in Hiro. They went into a small bistro in a secluded part of the neighborhood. Sara was an expert on secluded small bars and restaurants all over Tokyo. And before they ate, Tsukuru told her how he had seen his two former friends in Nagoya and what they had talked about. It wasn't easy for him to summarize, so it took a while for him to tell her the whole story. Sara listened closely, occasionally stopping him to ask a question.
So Shiro told the others that when she stayed at your apartment in Tokyo, you drugged her and raped her?
That's what she said.
She described it in great detail, very realistically, even though she was so introverted and always tried to avoid talking about sex.
That's what Ao said.
And she said you had two faces, Sara asked.
She said I had another dark, hidden side, something unhinged and detached from the side of me that everyone knew.
Sara frowned and thought this over for a while.
Doesn't this remind you of something? Didn't you ever have some special, intimate moment that passed between you and Shiro?
Tsukuru shook his head. Never. Not once. I was always conscious of not letting something like that happen.
Always conscious?
I tried not to view her as someone of the opposite sex, and I avoided being alone with her as much as I could.
Sara narrowed her eyes and inclined her head for a moment.
Do you think the others in the group were just as careful? In other words, the boys not viewing the girls as members of the opposite sex, and vice versa?
I don't know what the others were thinking, deep down inside. But like I said, it was a kind of unspoken agreement between us that we wouldn't let male-female relationships be a part of the group. We were pretty insistent about that.
But isn't that unnatural? If boys and girls that age get close to each other and are together all the time, it's only natural that they start to get interested in each other sexually.
I wanted to have a girlfriend and to go out on dates, just the two of us. And of course I was interested in sex, just like anybody else. And no one was stopping me from having a girlfriend outside the group. But back then, that group was the most important part of my life. The thought hardly ever occurred to me to go out and be with anyone else.
Because you found a wonderful harmony there,
Tsukuru nodded.
when I was with them. I felt like an indispensable part of the whole. It was a special feeling that I could never get anywhere else.
Which is why all of you had to look past any sexual interest, Sara said. In order to preserve the harmony the five of you had together, so as not to destroy the perfect circle.
Looking back on it now, I can see there was something unnatural about it. But at the time, nothing seemed more natural. We were still in our teens, experiencing everything for the first time. There was no way we could be that objective about our situation.
In other words, you were locked up inside the perfection of that circle. Can you see it that way?
Tsukuru thought about this. Maybe that's true. But we were happy to be locked up inside it. And I don't regret it, even now.
Intriguing, Sara said.
Sara was also quite interested to hear about Aka's visit with Shiro in Hamamatsu 6 months before she was murdered.
It's a different situation, of course, Sara said. But it reminds me of a classmate of mine from high school. She was beautiful, with a nice figure, from an affluent family, raised partly abroad and fluent in English and French, always at the top of her class. People noticed her, no matter what she did. She was revered by everybody. The heartthrob of all the younger students. We went to a private all-girls high school. So that sort of admiration by underclassmen could be pretty intense.
Tsukuru nodded.
She went on to Seishin University, the famous women's private college, and studied abroad in France for 2 years. A couple of years after she got back, I had the chance to see her, and when I did, I was floored. I'm not sure how to put it, but she seemed faded, like something that's been exposed to strong sunlight for a long time and the color fades. She looked much the same as before, still beautiful, still with a nice figure, but she seemed paler, fainter than before. It made me feel like I should grab the TV remote to ramp up the color intensity. It was a weird experience. It was hard to imagine that someone could, in the space of just a few years, visibly diminish like that. Sara had finished her meal and was waiting for the dessert menu. She and I weren't all that close, but we had a few friends in common, so I'd run into her every now and again. And each time I saw her, she'd faded a little more. From a certain point on, it was clear to everyone that she wasn't pretty anymore, that she was no longer attractive. It was like she'd gotten less intelligent, too. The topics she talked about were boring, her opinions stale and trite. She married at 27, and her husband was some elite government official, an obviously shallow, boring man. But the woman couldn't seem to grasp the fact that she was no longer beautiful, no longer attractive, no longer the sort of person people notice. She still acted like she was the queen. It was pretty pathetic to watch. The dessert menu arrived, and Sara inspected it closely. Once she had made up her mind, she closed the menu and laid it on the table. Her friends gradually stopped seeing her. It was just too painful to witness. Maybe it wasn't exactly pain they felt when they saw her, but more a kind of fear, the kind of fear most women have. The fear that your peak attractiveness as a woman is behind you, and you either don't realize it or refuse to accept it, and go on acting the way you always have, and then people snub you and laugh at you behind your back. For her, that peak came earlier than for others. That's all it was. In her teens, all her natural gifts burst into bloom, like a garden in spring, and once those years had passed, they quickly withered. The white-haired waiter came over, and Sara ordered the lemon souffle.
Tsukuru was always impressed at how she never skipped dessert, yet managed to keep her trim figure.